From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Coming up this week, a group of upstate lawmakers are asking the state to step in and fund refugee resettlement programs caught up in President Trump's travel ban. Our political observer Alan Shartok shares his thoughts on a change in the power balance in the New York State Senate. And a state assemblywoman introduces legislation on carbon farming she says is the first of its kind. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. A group of upstate lawmakers are asking New York State to step in and fund refugee resettlement programs that they say have been caught up in President Trump's travel ban and the resulting chaos. More from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
The federal government funds refugee resettlement centers located in cities in upstate New York. But under the rules, the money for staff is based on the number of refugees coming in. When President Trump's travel ban briefly froze the entry of refugees from the seven majority Muslim countries, the funding for the resettlement centers dried up too. Assemblyman Sean Ryan is from the Buffalo area, where 1,800 refugees resettled in 2016. He says the ban sent shockwaves through New York's refugee resettlement system and that people already in the U.S. still need the vital services.
Without funding, the agencies wouldn't be able to serve the refugees who have already come to New York or are currently being resettled.
Ryan was joined by lawmakers representing Rochester, Utica, and Albany. They're asking the state to step in and bridge the gap and provide $12 million in the new budget for the centers to keep helping people who have newly arrived in New York. They say there have already been layoffs of resettlement workers. Jill Peckinpah is with the Albany branch of the U.S. Committee on Refugees and Immigrants. She says the work involves everything from locating an apartment so those getting off the plane have a place to live to simple, everyday life decisions.
How to use a machine at the laundromat, how much is 25 cents worth, how to get on the buses, how to find familiar foods in the grocery stores.
Assemblyman Anthony Brindisi of Utica says New York owes a debt to its most recent refugees. He says the 15,000 or so who have resettled in his city in the past several years have revitalized whole neighborhoods.
Many upstate cities would be an empty shell if it wasn't for our refugees and immigrant communities. And we want to make sure that we continue to be welcoming, we continue to accept these wonderful people into our communities, and that the state provides the resources to allow our cities to continue to grow and accept refugees.
Even though the president's executive order on the travel ban has been stayed by a federal appeals court, Assemblyman Ryan says the flow of people settling in New York has not resumed in full, and the future is very uncertain.
The light switch didn't just turn back on, and refugees aren't fully coming back in. So, you know, it's a multi-week process to get you from a displaced person camp in Thailand into America. And right now, the agencies abroad aren't prepared to spend the money on an if-come that you could get stopped at the border again.
The funding gap in the settlement programs impacts upstate because the federal government decides where to send the refugees and has determined that New York City and other downstate areas were just too expensive. The lawmakers say the refugees are fully documented and that many have spent years in refugee camps while they were vetted to come to the U.S. The legislators, all Assembly Democrats, say Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie is supportive of their plan, but it also has to pass the state Senate, which is led by a coalition of Republicans and breakaway Democrats. And so far, they have not taken a position. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Alan, this week, let's start with the issue that we just heard raised by our Capitol correspondent, Karen DeWitt, where a group of upstate lawmakers now are asking the state to step in and fund refugee settlement programs that they say have been caught up in President Trump's travel ban and the resulting chaos. Side by side with that, of course, the Senate Democrats pushing for New York to be a sanctuary state after recent immigration raids. And we've just witnessed immigrants across the country, including New York, on Thursday, staying home from school and work, saying how critical they are to the U.S. economy and way of life. It was called a day without immigrants. Your thoughts on what's happening in this area?
First of all, it's interesting because Trump is commanding so much of the energy of the press that, you know, very little about what's going on in New York is important enough for people to really be paying attention to that. But you're right. When you take a situation in which Trump is alienating many of the blue states the way that he is, and that's where the so-called resistance is really coming from: New York, California, Massachusetts. Those are states which are really significantly opposed to the Trump agenda. And as each of the officers of those states looks at the political opportunities that are raised here, after all, if you're in a state which really doesn't like Trump, including his own home state of New York, then people look to you. So we have Senator Schumer. People are pushing him like crazy. The Attorney General of New York State, Eric Schneiderman, has been known to be really gutsy about going after Trump. But people want more, so they're always pushing him to do more. So each of these blue states are the center of resistance and are potentially the place where you will see much of this angst about Trump coming out. And it is the political officials in these states who will have a lot of pressure on them. So, for example, there's a question of sanctuary state in New York State or sanctuary city in New York City. And you have Trump implicitly, I think, threatening that you don't get your money if you become a sanctuary place, because it is clearly a shot at him. He grows weaker with the resignation of General Flynn and the nomination turned down of Labor Secretary designate Puzder. It does appear that this whole thing grows in these very blue states. And so I think that's what you can expect to be coming in the future.
Well, the future for the state Senate, as we had an election for the New York City Council this week where Senator Bill Perkins, a Democrat from Harlem, easily won this week his old seat on the city council in a nine-way special election, and he immediately resigns his post. What's important about this, as Ken Lovett writes in the Daily News, it would mean even if all nine breakaway Senate Democrats were aligned with Republicans that rejoined the fold, as progressives demand, the Dems would be a vote shy of holding the majority for at least several months.
That's right. And of course, we don't know. We really don't know whether Andrew Cuomo wants the Republicans in power. There's a general assumption that he does, that he has always wanted the Republicans to control things so that the progressive forces in New York State don't run away with Storr. He came in as a conservative governor. He lost his left flank. He started to play to the left flank. Now Perkins goes to the city council. Perkins was a member of the group of loyal Democrats. And often those are people of color and people of Latino descent, as opposed to the IDC or the breakaway or the traitor Democrats who have made common cause with the Republicans. And Perkins, of course, is a big loss for that group, because as one goes over and defects to the IDC group of the rogue Democrats who have made cause with the Republicans, that hurts the regular Democrats. Perkins' resignation going to New York City, that hurts the regular Democrats. And if I'm Andrea Stewart Cousins, who is the minority leader of this group of regular Democrats, I'm holding my head with an Excedrin headache.
From there to the snow, Alan. There's been quite a bit of snow this past couple of weeks in New York, two major snowstorms, and with that, a column that came from Chris Churchill of the Albany Times-Union. When the snow falls, it's Andrew Cuomo to the rescue.
Well, as you know, Andrew Cuomo, if you read about Andrew Cuomo's early life, you will know that he made his money while in college by working, I believe, for the AAA or for the road, on a road crew. And he would go out and all night long, and he would rescue people in their cars. So when they're riding along with some of his press people or his assistants, he sees a car on the side of the road. He goes over and he pushes. Chris Churchill wrote a wonderful column, very funny, basically saying if he was pushing, shouldn't the photographer who was taking his picture from his staff have been helping with the pushing rather than taking the pictures? And then Chris goes into a big thing about what politicians will do in order to be perceived as being the people's servants. In any case, it was a hysterical column, maybe a little unfair, because after all, one's got to figure that, you know, you see somebody on the side of the road, the name of the game is get out and help. And it is something that a lot of us have been pushing for a long time. You get cold or snow, you know, help your neighbor, check in. So I don't think it's entirely fair to hit on Cuomo for doing what's right because he's suspected of having political motives. On the other hand, it's a pretty funny column.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok joining us. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Public interest, environmental, and labor groups have filed a federal lawsuit challenging the legality of President Donald Trump's executive order requiring federal agencies to eliminate two existing regulations for every new one. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
The so-called one-in, two-out order was signed January 30th. It states new regulations must have a net cost of $0 in the current fiscal year, without considering the value of benefits to public health and safety. Trump was flanked by 9 small business owners when he signed the document.
We have to knock out 2 regulations for every new regulation. So if there's a new regulation, they have to knock out 2. But it goes far beyond that. We're cutting regulations massively for small business.
Trump noted his order would enable businesses to open and expand very easily. Amit Narang is a regulatory policy advocate at Public Citizen. He says the order could severely impact agencies that are supposed to be protecting the public. Agencies involved run the gamut from consumer product and food safety to environmental protection to those regulating Wall Street.
Let me give you an example. When it comes to the EPA, you know, the EPA is supposed to protect the public from numerous air pollution, water pollution, and other types of environmental risks to human health and also to the environment itself. What this executive order would force the EPA to do is essentially, if they're going to produce new regulations, which they are, they're planning in 2017 to produce updated lead standards in drinking water, make sure that we have the strongest standards against lead in drinking water, of course, in the wake of the Flint, Michigan tragedy. If the EPA is going to regulate lead in drinking water, well, it's going to have to get rid of a regulation that costs industry as much as the regulation of lead will cost industry. So that's going to really give them a Sophie's choice where they're going to have to get rid of another very, very important regulation that's benefiting the public, say, limiting mercury pollution from power plants.
Those who support Trump's order argue it will strike down unnecessary regulations hampering small business growth. David Goldston, director of government affairs with the Natural Resources Defense Council, calls the order illogical in part because when it comes to protections and safeguards, it looks at the costs of industry complying, but not the cost to the public of inaction.
We think this violates numerous laws which require a thoughtful consideration of costs and benefits, or at least of benefits, when the government is deciding how to protect the public from air pollution, from financial fraud, from unsafe food, or any other threat. So we think this is very much in keeping with the strategy the congressional Republican leaders and President Trump have laid out to try to undermine the regulatory system. We do not think that this is something that the public supports, and we don't think it's something that the courts will permit.
Narang says every federal agency is at risk.
I think it really becomes obvious to the public when you have these massive and eye-opening disasters that are due to a lack of regulation. I'm thinking here of the BP oil spill, the numerous oil train derailments. You have types of disasters when it comes to drinking water, not only in Flint, but these algae outbreaks in Ohio and other parts of the country. that make water basically toxic for human consumption, force folks to drink bottled water and use bottled water. Pipeline spills. We're constantly seeing these. Agencies have to be able to respond to these issues with new regulations. And if you're basically saying you got to get rid of regulations before you do new ones, it's going to make it very difficult for agencies to respond in these emergency situations.
The lawsuit was filed last Wednesday in federal district court in Washington, D.C. Narang believes it will be taken up in a matter of months. He's hopeful it will be resolved before the order starts having an impact in blocking agencies from producing new regulations. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
A New York State Assemblywoman has introduced legislation on carbon farming she says is the first of its kind. The idea is to promote environmentally friendly farming practices while at the same time putting money back into the pockets of farmers. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn.
Democrat Dee Dee Barrett has sponsored a bill that creates a carbon farming tax credit. Barrett, who represents portions of Columbia and Dutchess counties, says the plan will give farmers a new tax break while helping the state reach its climate change goals.
This would make New York State the first in the country, and I'm very excited about, you know, about something that really, you know, is a win-win for, you know, for our environment and for our farmers, and have New York be the lead on it.
The 2014 Farm Bill gave USDA authority to provide technical assistance to farmers and landowners in support of their response to climate change. Barrett says that while other states like California have also begun to develop programs with similar aims, New York's carbon farming tax credit would be the first of its kind to create a tax break for farmers who use climate-smart methods. Barrett says she had been speaking with farmers over the past few years about whether they thought such a tax credit would be beneficial.
In continuing this conversation, in the midst of one of them, I said, do you think that if we created a tax credit for practices that put carbon back in the soil and obviously therefore take it out of the atmosphere, that farmers would find that attractive?
And these conversations led to her crafting the bill. Barrett, who sits on both the Assembly's Agriculture and Environmental Conservation Committees, says there are items that still need to be worked out, such as metrics or figuring out how to measure carbon in the soil. She says metrics on the USDA website are a good place to start.
What we need to work on next is really figuring out, you know, how we measure the changes. You know, at one point you start and then you measure what the carbon content in the soil is. And then after, you know, a particular cycle, measure again to see the change and the increase and then develop a tax credit based on that.
Steve Ammerman is spokesman for the New York Farm Bureau.
It's a very interesting concept and addresses a lot of conservation practices that more and more farmers are already using, things like no-till and the use of cover crops in planting off-season, some really, you know, great environmental stewardship opportunities that our farmers are using. In terms of this specific bill, to tell you the truth, we really don't have a position on it yet because it is something that's new. We have no member-approved public policy on this. This is something that our farmers haven't talked about in relationship to what's called carbon farming and tax credits. So we're going to be talking more with the Assemblywoman about the bill, get more specifics on how it's going to work. And our state board of directors will be meeting again in April, and more than likely this is something that they're going to take up and talk about the bill.
Chris Pavelski is an Orange County onion farmer and executive director of FarmRoot, an organization that advocates for specialty crop family farms.
Well, obviously anything that promotes, in particular, cover crop use, saving of soil is very important.
He says a carbon farming tax credit that monetarily supports such practices is a good idea.
And right now, you know, even though it's a good practice, there's not a lot of financial incentive to do it, and it can be, to be honest, very expensive to pay, especially in terms of the seed to put out for the cover crops in particular. So something that encourages that obviously is a good thing.
With federal agencies facing the threat of being downsized and the potential of losing assistance and programs to farmers, Barrett says state action is even more critical.
You know, we want to be sure that New York continues to be a leader and has, you know, both by passing something like this kind of tax break, but also making sure that the resources are there for the soil resilience and the increased productivity that will help us in general agriculture. Because, you know, the bottom line is this is where our food comes from.
So far, the bill has 11 co-sponsors and 4 multi-sponsors. Barrett says she will soon reach out to state senators to introduce a companion bill in that chamber.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Some Hoosick Falls residents already exposed to chemicals in their drinking water may also have another form of pollutant leaking into their homes. Honeywell, under a consent order with the state, is conducting an investigation into the detection of chemicals in one of its former buildings in town. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard attended a meeting this week where company representatives spoke to residents.
Honeywell operated in Hoosick Falls from 1986 to 1996. The company, along with Saint-Gobain, has been deemed responsible by New York State authorities for the contamination of local water supplies with the chemical PFOA. That discovery has led to a year of public meetings, health concerns, and the establishment of a water filtration system. But the focus Tuesday night was on another type of pollutant called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs. Recently, chemicals nicknamed TCE and 111-TCA were discovered at the location of Honeywell's former John Street facility. Now under consent order with the New York State Departments of Health and Environmental Conservation, Honeywell is asking permission from residents to test their homes for VOCs. John Morris, Global Remediation Director for Honeywell, explained to the crowd in the gymnasium that Honeywell is investigating 39 properties surrounding the former facility.
We need an access agreement. We need to have your permission, and won't do it without your permission, to come in and do this testing.
Morris explained that VOCs travel into homes through vapors released from contaminated groundwater. Testing will be done in the basement and living areas of targeted homes. Levels of VOCs detected in Hoosick Falls range from 6 parts per billion to more than 100 parts per billion. The state action level is 5 parts per billion. Morris could not answer a question on how long residents may have been exposed.
We are conducting an investigation to determine whether there is exposure now. What happened in the past is very difficult to recreate.
According to DOH fact sheets, TCE is a known carcinogen. It can affect the central nervous system, liver, kidneys, reproductive, and immune systems, and may also cause birth defects. Long-term exposure to 111-TCA can affect the heart, liver, and nervous system, but it is not yet proven to cause cancer in humans. For some residents in Hoosick Falls who have been worried over their health from long-term exposure of PFOA for more than a year now, the meeting was as worrying as it was frustrating.
I'm really sick and tired of it. You know, but the thing is, what are you going to do?
Carol Wilwall lives across the street from the former John Street site and also had been exposed to PFOA while connected to the village water system before a filtration system was installed. Wilwall has lived in Hoosick Falls for 56 years, her entire life.
It's a great village. I love living here. And my concern about this VOC or whatever they're calling it is the levels that are going to be in my home. I don't want to leave my home. But I also don't want to get sick from something.
Questions persisted at the meeting for over an hour, but Justin Deming of the State Health Department cautioned the audience to not jump to conclusions about health effects this early in the investigation.
So in the event we do the testing and there's no exposure, there's no concern for any sort of health outcome.
Honeywell's consent order with the state covers the John Street site and a location on River Road. A separate consent order with Saint-Gobain and Honeywell includes the facilities on McCaffrey Street and Liberty Street. Jim Morris with DEC explained that the agency is looking at 4 sites in Hoosick Falls for VOCs, and he expected more information to be released in the near future.
We have to share the information with the private property owners first before we make that information public knowledge. In addition, in March, we're planning an availability session to discuss all the available data that we have for the 4 sites.
Not discussed at Tuesday's meeting was the proposed settlement between Saint-Gobain and Honeywell in the village of Hoosick Falls over costs incurred by the village during the PFOA contamination case. An offer to reimburse the village for $850,000 was tabled by the village board for future consideration in January.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1707, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.